WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for what is certainly one of the most interesting times of your life and all of our lives. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. Something that all of us really do want. As those of you who have heard our shows for well over a decade, since 2007, you know that the climate crisis has been one of our main focuses. And as we go forward, it's going to continue to be even more of a prime focus because as the years go by, the situation becomes more and more urgent, especially in the face of inaction currently at the highest level of our government. And we've done many shows on virtually all aspects of climate change. Our guests have ranged from people from all kinds of environmental and health organizations to NASA scientist Gavin Schmidt to the CEO of the Long Island Power Authority, all giving a very consistent message. And over the hundreds of hours of uninterrupted programming we've done, we've outlined a rather incontrovertible set of facts that I feel would convince even, say, a doorknob that the climate change issue is happening and that we need to act on this crisis quickly and decisively. So even if you were to just take one of the many aspects of the climate disruption that's already here and accelerating, whether it's the health implications for humans, the impacts on our life support system, to our air and water supply, the impacts on biodiversity, the impacts on very stability of our society with rising sea levels and water shortages, that could just change everything. And I could go on. It couldn't be more clear that this will be the defining issue of this century, barring the unforeseen. However, as most of you likely know, there are a decent number of people out there who, while clearly a minority, and despite the repeated clear call from the world scientists and all the organizations, that don't believe that climate change is real. Now, these people are not necessarily just skeptical by nature. They have, however, been systematically and very skillfully misinformed over the course of years and years. And with all the shows we've done, we've talked about this many times, but we've never specifically addressed how and from whom this misinformation has been spread to Americans and the people of the world. But that's about to change right now because on today's show, we have a guest, Brendan DeMille, and he's with DSMOG, considered to be the world's number one source for accurate, fact-based information regarding global warming misinformation campaigns. And you could go to DSMOG, that's DESMOG.com. Brendan DeMille is executive director of DSMOG. He's also a freelance writer and researcher specializing in media, politics, climate change, and clean energy. He served as a research associate for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., researcher for The Ring of Fire, researcher for Laurie David, who produced An Inconvenient Truth, law and policy analyst for Environmental Working Group, who we've discussed on this show many times, and among many other positions. His work has appeared in Vanity Fair, The Huffington Post, Grist, The Washington Times, and other outlets. He comes to us today from Seattle, Washington. Welcome to The Healthy Planet, Brendan.
Hi, Bob. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And I've been looking at your work for years, and it has been invaluable, as I'll be talking about in a little bit. Let's start out by you sharing about how you became interested in climate denial and misinformation in the first place.
Sure. I grew up in New England, grew up in Lakeville, Connecticut, and went to St. Lawrence University, and that's where I started to study attacks on environmentalism was how it started for me. Was I was an environmental studies and sociology major, and it was really intriguing to me to study the ways that the green movement and Earth Day was under attack, and you know how this growing network of think tanks and voices was attacking environmental efforts. And so that was my first sort of taste.
What year was that?
97, okay. 98, around in Got there. A year later, actually, when I was working for CONPIRG, the Public Interest Research Group in Hartford, I met this journalist named Ross Gelbspan, who was an author of the first and sort of seminal books on climate misinformation. And he sort of connected the dots between the coal industry and the fossil fuel industry, actually seeding this misinformation campaign and building it and funding it. And that was when I first started to understand this threat. And then fast forward many years, in 2007, I met the DSMOG folks. They had launched the project in sort of early 2006. And I started to get involved and became intrigued. Actually, one other note was after Environmental Working Group, I helped a Greenpeace researcher build the Exxon Secrets database, which was another fascinating look at all of the Exxon money that flowed to climate misinformation campaigns. So, and it was actually through that Greenpeace contact, Kurt Davies, how I met the DSMOG team. And as you mentioned, I was working for Laurie David at the time and in Inconvenient Truth and you know, all of those efforts, StopGlobalWarming.org, which was a bipartisan effort to raise awareness around climate action. So it was right then, really, that DSMOG came onto my radar in a big way, and I got a chance to join the team. And I've been able to, I've been leading the show at DSMOG for the past 11 years, and it's been really rewarding to build up the team of investigative journalists and look into this issue in a really, concentrated way. And what we found is has shocked me. Every year I learn something more about the history of misinformation and the ways that the, the Koch family and the Mercer family and other billionaire interests have created this architecture of disinformation and denial that's undermined our democracy in so many ways, and of course, delayed action on climate change.
Now, you came in at an interesting time. A few years after you came in with DSMOG was the time that at least I thought, hey, it's getting better. George Bush is saying it's real. Dick Cheney is doing commercials on climate change, telling people to acknowledge it and take action. And then, of course, things fell apart. So you must have gotten a rush at that point.
It was absolutely fascinating times. We had this, as I mentioned, StopGlobalWarming.org, which was founded by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Senator McCain and Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was truly a bipartisan effort, and it was really exciting. And then everything fell apart. McCain became a climate denier and ended up, joining the Republican bandwagon on science denial, and that was really unfortunate. So we really did see this deep polarization and politicization of the issue that continues to this day.
Yep. And the way things changed on a dime back then and then changed back, I'm assuming that one of these moments it will switch back to some kind of sane approach.
I hope the pendulum swings.
Oh, boy. Well,
we certainly need it.
Yeah, we certainly do. So if you do a lot of reading and research into climate, as I do, and you at some point will inevitably find yourself reading stories on DSMOG, there's so much valuable information there, and you can certainly get lost in the pages for quite a while. And with that said, many of our listeners are likely hearing about DSMOG for the first time. So explain DSMOG's mission and history.
Sure. So DSMOG, as I mentioned, was founded in sort of late 2005 by a couple of Canadian folks who were concerned, in particular, our founder, James Hogan, who is a public relations expert in Canada, runs a great PR firm up there that would, was trying to get corporations to do the right thing and message, truthfully to people. And he was outraged at what he saw in the PR industry with the number of firms that were working for the oil industry in spreading misinformation about climate. And it made him angry, and as we know, is a great motivator. Yeah. So he started the DSMOG blog project back then to call out his sort of companions in the PR industry. That was where it started, sort of like a project of his PR firm. And but over the years, and particularly when Jim hired me to run the organization, I decided to pursue a more investigative journalistic approach and bring on some great reporters and researchers. And we've been able to grow the organization over the past 10 years into a global team. We saw that the spread of misinformation was truly happening beyond where the initial focus was, which was the US. You know, it was a couple of, you know, Canadians concerned about what was happening in the US at the time. And then we started to see what was happening in Canada. So we actually started DSmog Canada just to focus on the Harper years, Stephen Harper administration that denied the science and undermined Canada's action strategies. We had a reporter based in Australia, and we started to see lots of activity and misinformation and a lot of flow of the same characters from the United States down to Australia and sort of helping them pollute the public conversations about energy and climate. So, and then in the UK as well, we saw what was happening. And so we launched DSmog UK 5 years ago now, I think.
Great.
And that actually became an incredible, you know, hot spot for climate denial and for activity that's led to Brexit and, you know, the destruction of the European Union and the UK leaving and lots of other things that we were able to put some deep research into, noting the connections of the Coke industry funded network in how that came about. So we became a global, you know, sort of investigative research unit out of this. And we have sort of a hybrid model where we, you know, on DSmog, you can just go to dsmog.com and our UK site as well, as you can find it there. But we just decided that we needed to provide a resource to people. So we have our research databases as well as our investigative journalism. So those we profile over 700 people in the disinformation database, which focuses on climate denial, and another about 100 in our Koch network database. And again, sort of individuals and organizations that have been operatives for the Koch agenda or spreading disinformation on any number of issues. And then, yeah, we've got our team that's spread out all over the US and Canada and indeed, you know, all over the world. Our Australia program is on hold. Our reporter down there, Graham Redfern, joined The Guardian full-time as environment reporter, which is great. We've had some other sort of alumni of DSmog go on to great outlets. Chris Mooney, who you might recognize from the front pages of The Washington Post, wrote for DSmog for many years. And so, yeah, now we have a great team of journalists and researchers who are continuing to carry this mission, which is really, we want to call to account those who've been responsible for the misinformation on and the attacks on scientists and activists and advocates of climate action. And so that's what we continue to this day. It's grueling work, not always fun. Honestly, we were feeling pretty good about things before President Trump happened. You know, there was sort of a recognition that climate science denial wasn't acceptable, and it was growing increasingly uncomfortable in the Republican Party. But now, you know, all bets are off. We've seen the attacks on science and the rollbacks that the Trump administration has done, and pulling the United States out of the Paris Accord and everything. So we're in dangerous territory, which, you know, again, DSmog's mission was, you know, is all about this. So,
yeah, we are in dangerous territory for sure. And you had mentioned briefly one specific resource on DSmog that I've used many, many times, and that's really invaluable and time-saving for me, because I do what I do. I get everyone from friends and family and acquaintances sending me articles about the most recent revelation from this or that supposed expert on climate change. But actually, some of those, they're climate deniers or denier organizations. And some of them I'm familiar with, but some of them I don't know. But I go to DSmog's climate disinformation database, and I'm able to get all kinds of information about the people who other people are asking me to look at. So it's really valuable. Talk more about that resource.
Yeah, it really is the product of a massive amount of research done over the past 15 years. And we built it just as a factual resource for journalists originally was our target audience, was just to lay out what we could document of who these individuals and organizations are, who their funding sources are, and what their deeds and actions and things they've said are over time. And it's really grown into, in some cases, like our Coke, some of our profiles on some of these industries or on some of these organizations are a bit unwieldy almost, like our profile in the Heartland Institute and Competitive Enterprise Institute. But they really are, and they show up high in Google, which is great. So people can find this fact-based information when they hear of a name of an individual or an organization in the media, and they don't know whether to believe them or not. That's, we provide the facts about who they are and what their motivations are. So, and like I said, there's over 700 profiles in that. It's growing every day. We're adding new profiles, and maintaining it is a full-time job for our research director.
Yeah, it's really interesting information. You would think that a database of people and what they've done and who they're connected to would be kind of dry reading, but it's not. I was reading last night about the Koch brothers and their role in funding climate denial. And Koch industry is the largest privately owned energy company in the United States, according to your post. And yep. The country's second largest private company, they wield a lot of money. And since 1997, they've donated over $100 million to 84 groups denying climate change. And I'll tell you, just, it was so interesting. In addition to finding out all the facts about them, I found out about the fact that the Koch brothers' father, Fred Koch, built a major airplane fuel refinery for Adolf Hitler. And that became the biggest refinery fueling the Luftwaffe as it bombed civilians. And then he also helped create the John Birch Society, which was a far-right group that attacked the civil rights movement. And this is from your disinformation database. So it's really interesting reading, and I recommend everybody to go to dsmog.com and take a look at that.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I mean, it really is. It's been an incredible journey tracking. I actually started tracking the Koch brothers and the Koch industries back in my environmental working group days when I first started looking into Koch in 2002, which seems like a very, very long time ago, but about how they've played such a central role in the creation of this echo chamber of disinformation. And, Charles Koch was a big adherent to the vision of spreading think tanks all over the globe. And they've certainly had plenty of money to plow into that network. And it has been a key source of undermining public trust in science and undermining public trust in agencies like the United Nations and the World Health Organization. And it's also, just sort of, I think their ideology and their profit motive combine in their think tank strategy, which is just to undermine public trust in government and in institutions that protect us. And that's, in part an ideological neoliberal. As we learned more about the Koch family's history of an ideological agenda combined with the profit motive of their corporation, which is in oil services and fossil fuel heavy industry, we noted this overlap in their think tank network that they fund, with millions of dollars, and as we laid out on our website, in situations like when climate science requires that we take global cooperative action and that people put their trust in science and government to solve this global crisis, that butts up against their worldview. And so that's where their think tanks have come in to create confusion and undermine public confidence in science and in democracy and in agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, that standards and regulations that protect our health are a threat to their bottom line. And Koch Industries is one of the most notorious violators of pollution regulations over decades. So they have a vested interest and also a political interest in attacking science and attacking the public's trust in science.
Sure. They're big, they're powerful, they have an interest in it, and they have a decided opinion that is in contrast to what is necessary and beneficial for humanity. So that's a dangerous combination.
It certainly is, and it's and they're not alone. I mean, there's other interests that we've tracked over the years. The Mercer family, which of course I'm sure your viewers or your listeners are familiar with, that Robert Mercer's fortune that helped propel Trump to the White House through Breitbart and Steve Bannon and all those folks that were working on Mercer's dime to push Trump into the White House, and many other sort of fossil fuel interests. Of course, I mentioned Exxon earlier. Exxon's been a key funder of climate misinformation for, you know, two decades, as well as the coal industry. We've gotten to go deep, and part of DSmog's strategy is to go find, you know, these collections and archives of paper documents and put them online to show, you know, the roles that the coal barons played in funding climate misinformation that was in part unknown for many years. And then again, deeply investigating the Exxon collections. And we found, you know, after Inside Climate News and the LA Times and others collaborated to expose Exxon for its knowledge, we actually went and revisited some of those archives and found additional documents that showed Exxon's, you know, deep knowledge and understanding of the science. And then we have clearly demonstrated how they pivoted to attacking the science and ignoring the problem to prolong their ability to profit from selling fossil fuels. Mm.
There's so much at stake for short-term profits. It's hard to believe that this could be going on in a civilized world where we purportedly care about each other, we care about children, we care about future generations. And yet, in the name of short-term profit, knowing full well the issues that are going to be created by this catastrophe that's coming, they're willing to go ahead with misinformation and just throwing everybody off and attempting to get the public to have doubt, and very effectively doing so. Mm-hmm. So from the early days of the emergence of COVID-19, it was really apparent that some of the same dynamics were in play in terms of how our elected officials dealt with climate change. They were at play in dealing with COVID-19. In fact, it's been interesting to watch the COVID-19 timeline as kind of a mini time-compressed version of climate change. The initial reaction of the Trump administration was to downplay its severity. But as the facts emerged, they had to acknowledge it because there were bodies building up. People were dying in large numbers, so it just couldn't be denied. With climate change, however, that same sequence of denial and ultimate acceptance has not yet played itself out. It started to at one point, but as they're holding on to their denial, apparently to the bitter ends, it's going to take a longer time for them to come around. And DSmog's actually been tracking the overlaps between climate science denial and the COVID-19 denial and misinformation that we're seeing. But you've been doing it in a much more comprehensive way, digging beyond the outward appearances. So tell us about DSmog's tracking of the overlaps between these two big issues.
Absolutely. It was really fascinating for us to dig into this. It was, you know, in March when everybody was sort of getting their heads around this crisis, and you know, I'm in Seattle. We were one of the first states to sort of issue stay-at-home orders and start to see, you know, really scary things happening to our friends and neighbors, and, you know, lots of health impacts and people dying, as you said. And so my team just started to notice a few things here or there, you know, tweets downplaying the information, you know, downplaying the crisis, or saying, oh, this will blow over in a couple of weeks and, you know, this is no big deal, or using it as a way to attack environmental regulations. And we started to notice, again, as we have over the years tracking this same network, that there were a lot of the same voices that had suddenly become pandemic experts and claiming that we didn't need to worry about this. So we did a systematic approach of looking at many of the individuals and organizations in our databases to see what they were saying about COVID-19. And lo and behold, after several weeks of digging into this cesspool of just disgusting, you know, denial of the science and attacks on the medical community and the governors who are, you know, doing the right thing by issuing stay-at-home orders, you know, sure enough, there was a massive amount of data that we put together that showed this network, again, leading the charge of attacking science and undermining public trust in government's ability to respond to it. So we put together our COVID deniers report, which we released last week, and you can find on the website, and around media coverage has been great so far. And we ended up with over 300 pages of in a single document, which was just unwieldy. So in the report, we made it, we sort of segmented things into themes, buckets of how the misinformation has been spread by topic. So we looked at the ways that COVID deniers have used the crisis to attack climate action, actually, you know, and say that, this is a real crisis. Global warming isn't a real crisis. So, you know, just, or to say we don't need any more concern about climate change. We have a real pandemic on our hands. And, or they were using it to say, this is something that shows the benefits of fossil fuels because, you know, you've got all this plastic used in the medical, you know, by necessity, a lot of single use plastic, unfortunately, but, you know, that saves lives and is, you know, critical part of the response. But then they were pivoting to attack plastic bag bans and, you know, suggesting we don't need that and rah-rah plastic and lots of attacks on renewable energy that came about in the same breath. And of course, attacking the World Health Organization and spreading conspiracy theories, which were, you know, really odd and in many cases sort of racist, definitely xenophobic, you know, about the origins of the crisis. And, you know, I don't even want to give them oxygen, but they're there, they're tracked. And we did this to put them on record as, you know, these people were spreading, in many cases, dangerous distractions or misinformation about the crisis that could have led people to put themselves in harm's way. And we also have seen this growth of the liberate, you know, movement that the president's been stoking and the efforts to reopen the economy far sooner than the scientists say that we're ready, of course. And so those, we tracked the roots of some of those reopen movements to, again, Koch-funded entities, State Policy Network and American Legislative Exchange Council and Americans for Prosperity and, you know, others who have been encouraging people to protest against government lockdowns that are saving lives and protecting healthcare workers from influxes of patients. So we wanted to put them on record. And so we spent, you know, many weeks archiving this material, making sure that it can't be deleted, you know, from Twitter or wherever, because it's important for people to know who said what and when and how dangerous that activity is. So that's our COVID deniers report. It was many, many hands in the organization who put time into reading all this stuff, and it was a really difficult project, honestly, mentally taxing, but it was good to do for, like I said, to capture this for posterity. And again, our UK team also found evidence overseas of, you know, folks saying that this was a hoax invented by global elites like Bill Gates and George Soros to, you know, yeah. All these crazy things, but really dangerous and anti-science, of course, and not what we need to hear right now in a crisis that is harming a lot of lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, what I find alarming is that I am getting messages, video links, websites sent to me from people from all over about these conspiracy theories as if they are the truth and as if they have explored the other side of the argument and that they've come up with the fact that this is actually real and true and you should listen to this because this horrible conspiracy is taking our planet and our society. And it's getting to a worrying level at this point because it's spreading within different groups. It used to be that there was just the crazy conspiracy people. But now, and I apologize to the crazy conspiracy people that I know you're not crazy, but I disagree with some of your perspectives. But now it seems to be coming from a larger section of people who are really watching a lot of that. That's worrying.
It is. And we're in an interesting time where misinformation and disinformation that's manufactured to confuse and distort and create doubt travels really fast and really far with social media and YouTube videos and things. And it really is, it's up to everyone to just be vigilant about what you, what your sources of information are, and who you can trust, and look to science and look to resources that can hopefully debunk some of this. And so it doesn't confuse people or lead people to think that we can go on about our normal lives. So, and yeah, it is scary. And, you know, it travels fast. It travels through Facebook, you know, and family members share it with their friends, and it's dangerous. But again, it's important that we all band together and make sure that we can respond to it in ways that open ears and open minds and help people to understand that this is a real crisis. And just like the climate crisis, we have to act together and trust in science. And we can do it if we pay attention and do the right things. But it's not simple. And, you know, again, this has shown it's been incredibly impactful on the fossil fuel industry. And so there's also a profit motive to reopen the economy, to get people driving and flying.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the impacts in the oil and gas sector have been tremendous. And that's a sector that was already flagging before the crisis. So it'll be really interesting to see how things unfold over the coming weeks and months.
Yep, indeed.
WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook.
And by the way, to the people who are deeply embedded in watching these videos and listening to the conspiracy theories, I have to say that when I'm doing research, I do listen to some of that. I look at some of it. I look to see what they're leaving out. And I'll point this out to the people who contact me. But I will tell you that if I did not have a clear footing in knowing what was true and what wasn't, and knowing which sources to go to that were actually credible and which are not, it's very convincing. Their sources seem like they put very seemingly very credible experts behind the words and behind the videos. They present it in a professional way. And if I didn't know what I knew, I would say, hey, yes, this is terrible. And this is, I'd be right with them. Mm-hmm. But you can't just look at one side of things. And at this point, I hope that we can get everybody who is listening to the science and who does know about what a good source is to continue to share that with your friends, because fear is a great motivator. And a lot of this, the conspiracy stuff, is being motivated by fear. And these are some pretty deep fears that they're pushing around, you know, that the world is going to be suffering at the hand of the evil empire. And so they're operating out of fear. And I think it's really important for anybody who's operating out of clear knowledge and wisdom about what you've seen from the evidence to share that as vehemently as they are sharing the conspiracy theories. I've been watching, as I mentioned, the ebbs and flows of climate change denial for a couple of decades now. And from the denial of the early 2000s, and then what I mentioned about George Bush and Dick Cheney, and then the Tea Party coming out and backsliding. And then you see that the Republican Party position, the talking points have been morphing here and there. And at first they said it didn't exist and they were denying it, it was a hoax. And then it was, well, I'm not a scientist. And then it was, well, there's global warming, but it's just not something we could do anything about. And there are a whole bunch of variations. Now, there will be a time, I hope this is the case, there will be a time when the deniers and the Republican Party as a whole will have to admit that climate change is real and really a huge threat to our entire social order. So granted, to us, it seems impossible to deny it right now with everything that we're seeing, from the droughts and the storms and the wildfires and the record temperatures and the melting glaciers and everything, but they are denying it. So since you've studied climate denial more than anybody else I've interviewed, do you have any guesses about how they're going to segue from their current position to one of accepting the science once it becomes entirely impossible for them to deny it?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball when or how it'll work, but I do think we are seeing the cracks in the wall of denial, and there have been some responsible efforts put forward by conservative circles to address, you know, the climate crisis and recognize the science, and those are good. We need more of that. I think what'll ultimately happen, you know, there are a couple of dynamics at play. Number one is that the clean energy, you know, industries are advancing and are continuing to put pressure on the fossil fuel industry And so those fossil fuel industries are, I think, you know, waning in their political muscle because of the loss of just their control over our energy sector. Mm. And as people have more options for choosing greener sources of energy and electric cars, et cetera, it makes it less possible for Exxon and Coke to control Congress. So I hope to see the continued erosion of the political muscle that the fossil fuel industry has enjoyed over the past several decades. And I also think, you know, those voices of reason within the Republican Party and conservative circles stepping up to say, no, wait a minute. I mean, this is a real crisis. Climate change is real. We have to do something. And then, you know, there can be political arguments over how we respond rather than the flat out denial that was the order of the party for a long time. So I think there will be continued bravery, I guess you could call it at this point, of folks that step forward and acknowledge the science and try to build coalitions to get us back. You know, sadly, we have to get back to the kind of bipartisan support for climate action that we had, that we talked about earlier, in order to get that groundswell of support. But I also think, you know, there's this beautiful movement of people, you know, led by those most impacted communities who are rising up and gaining in their power. You know, the rise of the youth movements and, you know, the incredible signs of support for climate action that we saw in the marches and people getting into the streets, and that, you know, people power can overcome the fossil fuel power if, you know, we just keep displaying it. And there are interesting ways that it's starting to happen in the COVID crisis, you know, where people have to get creative about how to create political pressure when we can't fill the streets with protesters. And so that'll continue to evolve. But to me, I think economics is definitely another factor here, and the fossil fuel industry is hurting. You know, the fracking industry was already way in debt and falling out of favor in the market before this crisis, and of course we've seen the impacts. I think people will start to understand the geopolitical war that our energy system has been held hostage to because of the power of fossil fuels and the power of OPEC and Saudi Arabia and Russia and so many other players. When those dynamics go away, when we start turning to clean energy, and which is more democratized and decentralized, and we don't have to kowtow to billionaire interests if we choose different ways of running our lives. Mm,
indeed. And I also see hope with not only the youth movement that is working with climate change reality, with the Greta Thunbergs and everybody else, but young Republicans, I think, are not going to be able to hold on to this story because they're not stupid. They see what's coming, and they have a whole life in front of them. So I have hope that the young Republicans will also play a role in moving them towards some kind of sane acknowledgement of what's going on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, again, younger folks of all political persuasions have embraced the science and understand the need for action on climate. Obviously, we need to accelerate that movement, but it's great to see the youth energy and also, you know, the rising recognition of the impacts on communities of color from climate change and how those communities have risen up to demand, you know, action as well. And sadly, we are seeing, you know, the impacts of pollution on making COVID-19 worse. And in many communities along the Gulf Coast, where the Cancer Alley and Refinery Row, the areas where petrochemical activity and oil and gas activity is really high, and communities that have been impacted by that pollution are now suffering, you know, more deaths and worse consequences from COVID-19 as a result of that. And that's a dangerous and really scary prospect for a lot of polluted areas of the country, so, and the world. So I think, you know, yeah, we'll continue to see the rise of people power over corporate power. I just hope we can see that progress accelerate to the point where we can solve this problem and protect people's health.
Yeah. Now, many industries have obviously been suffering greatly with the country that's staying home. Explain what's happening in the oil and gas industry these days with COVID-19 happening, and what is it doing to them, and how are they reacting?
Well, the demand for oil and gas has, of course, shifted as people aren't traveling. And so there was already a sort of a buildup of capacity shortages. So in other words, the oil and gas that is produced had to be stored somewhere. And as we saw with President Trump trying to figure out how to bail out the oil and gas industry by offering up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve as a possible storage option, we've just seen that they're running out of places to store oil and gas. People may have seen sort of amazing footage of tankers parked at sea off the California coast and really all over the world that are just full of oil. And there's no demand because people aren't traveling, it's really put a strain on the industry. Prices for oil and gas have gone way down below levels that producers like Exxon can make money. So we're seeing a lot of bankruptcies in the sector. And we're seeing one of the weirdest things, though, early on, and actually still, is that there's still a lot of production that's happening in the Permian Basin in Texas and North Dakota and elsewhere, because some of these companies have to keep producing oil and gas in order to pay off their debts and appease their shareholders, or else they'll go bankrupt. So we're starting to see lots more bankruptcies. But unfortunately, as a result of that need to produce, they put their workers at risk, of course, which is just a terrible consequence. Oil and gas workers also wear personal protective equipment on the job because it's very dangerous what they're breathing and exposed to. So that PPE that really could have and should have been donated by the oil and gas industry to the medical front lines to solve the crisis was, instead used to produce oil that we don't need. Mm-hmm. And, so that's, and they put their workers at risk of infection and just really dangerous. So now we're also seeing now, of course, as they're slowing down production, the communities where they've been active are, losing out economically, of course. And it shows the boom and bust impact of this industry that's happened throughout history. And right now with the COVID-19 crisis, it's getting, again, really scary because a lot of these workers are in confined spaces, or operating in communities that, where they might get infected or be infected and put people in harm's way through their ongoing business activity. So it's going to be a different industry on the other side of this for sure, because we'll see that a lot of the companies will have gone bankrupt, and the further consolidation of oil and gas into the hands of Exxon and Chevron, the majors. But even we're seeing, signs from analysts and investors saying that even Exxon is sort of in delicate territory here as far as their viability as a company, which is amazing and really unprecedented, right? We always think of Exxon as this behemoth that could survive anything, but even they're being taxed with this crisis. So, and again, I think it will hopefully demonstrate that the renewable energy sector can rise up and be more resilient in crises like this and provide power and electricity and transportation mobility in ways that are more sustainable and certainly healthier for air quality and other ways. So it will be really interesting to see what happens as this unfolds.
Yeah, in a way, it's interesting to see the spot price of oil dropped below zero. And for people who are hearing this, that just means that they had to pay people to take it because they didn't have any place to put it. So I would love to see us stepping away from oil even when the price is so low, because truly, even if they paid us to use it, we shouldn't be using it. If we understood the full implications of what it was doing to our world, we wouldn't be using it at zero. So now we need to move ahead with a clean energy economy with low oil prices. And the oil price has nothing to do with it, because the oil price compared to the cost to our society going forward is minuscule. That's an interesting dynamic to watch, though.
Certainly is. You mentioned the prices falling below zero. That was already starting to happen in certain sectors of oil and gas. And so it's fascinating when you consider that you have to pay somebody to take your product off your hands.
Yeah.
because there's no market, or there's no way to get it to market, or there's no demand. And, you know, but yeah, that's reality in the Canadian tar sands that's happened. You know, that's that was already a financial failure, but now it's just, it's blowing up completely. And it's going to have a lot of impacts on people's lives. And same in the United States, there are communities and that have been reliant on fossil fuels, just like we saw with the downfall of the coal industry and the impacts that it had in communities in Appalachia. We'll see again now in communities where oil and gas economic activity has kept communities going, but that's busting. You know, that boom bust cycle is vicious, and it causes real pain for, you know, for ordinary families. And, yeah. And that's just not as evident in the clean energy sector. So I sure hope we can figure that out, because for all the other, not just the environmental benefits, but the social and sort of the real impacts on people's lives from the fossil fuel sector go far beyond just the pollution concerns and how they've undermined our democracy as well.
Yeah. And on that, in terms of impacts on the workers, I read DeSmog's new article based on Justin Noble's investigation into radiation threats to oil and gas workers. And as much as I've been reading about gas and oil, I hadn't heard about this and I didn't realize it was so serious. So talk about that article a little bit.
Yeah, it's a really, we didn't know anything about this issue either, which was kind of, you know, shocking after studying this industry for, you know, decades. But Justin Noble is an amazing, intrepid young reporter who, he came to us from Rolling Stone magazine, and he had a story about radiation that, you know, other outlets hadn't wanted to run. And he thought DeSmog would be a great place to do it. So, you know, he did, his first article was in Rolling Stone about this issue, but this one is another deeper dive into how oil and gas industry workers have been put at risk by their employers throughout the sector, throughout history, and globally. And so this new story that we have up on DeSmog on the front page now, that Justin Noble wrote, is an incredible deep dive into what he found interviewing whistleblowers, industry, you know, oil and gas workers whose lives have been ruined by the fact that they were put in harm's way without being warned by their employers by the amount of radiation that's involved in fossil fuel extraction. And it was really, it's been this sort of hidden tragedy that the workers have been exposed to. And Justin's done a really incredible job of bringing the workers' stories to the forefront and calling out the ways that the oil and gas companies have known this all along, that they were putting their workers in harm's way, that radiation levels at wellheads and in certain parts of infrastructure are just off the charts dangerous, you know. And, you know, we don't think of oil and gas as, you know, as essentially, you know, a radiation source, but they are. And in particular, the workers in the front lines are the ones taking the hit for it. And, you know, Justin's story traces this, in particular, as one man's saga of discovering when he was on the job in Syria that his employers had lied to him about the radiation threat, and that he had gone out and cleaned, that he'd been fixing a pipe that had broken at a wellhead, and he had cleaned the thing and inspected it with bare hands and no mask, and this guy's gotten horribly sick, and his son died of leukemia, and it's just a devastating story. But again, it shows the ways that the industry has put their workers in danger while knowing full well the impacts of what they were doing. And and Justin is actually writing a book about this subject now, so there'll be lots more of this coming at DeSmog, and lots more exposure of this issue of radiation threats. And this is an industry that's not only put us all in danger of the climate crisis, but has really been bad to its workers. And it's just really not it's irresponsible behavior that we shouldn't really tolerate in modern society. So, but again, this is our effort at DeSmog, is to call out this activity and hopefully, you know, hold those accountable who lied and deceived us over the years.
Yeah. I guess it shouldn't come as any surprise that they're not caring about their workers, considering the fact that they're spreading disinformation in a world where obviously climate change is a big threat, where you've got 3 plus 4 million people dying of outdoor air pollution alone every single year in the world. That these are some big numbers, and they know it. They know what's going on, and they're resisting the transition. So the fact that they're able to do that and then mistreat their workers makes perfect sense.
Yes.
Yeah, it's too bad. Too bad. It's horrible. But hopefully we'll be able to get these workers who are currently working in the gas and oil industry and get them jobs where they can actually not die from their work and be contributing to creating a better society and get a better pay and not have to go into coal mines and breathe in those fumes and breathe in that air and be around those substances, which are deadly to everybody.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. I mean, I think people deserve clean jobs, and to the extent that we can support industries that don't kill their workers, that would be, it seemed like a good way to go.
Pretty simple, right?
Yeah.
Don't kill your workers. We'll support you.
Right. Yep.
Brendan, we're almost out of time. Any final thoughts?
Well, I just, thanks, Bob, for having me. And, this is really unprecedented time we're living in, and it's quite scary. And there's lots of, on our minds every day. But it's just really, I think, encouraging to see that people are trusting in science, and hopefully we'll get through this, and that we can, hopefully see the return to better ways of doing things, as we just talked about, and use this opportunity and use this crisis as an opportunity to continue to build, cleaner and more resilient economy going forward that treats people and the planet with more respect. So I thank you for having me on.
That's such a pleasure. And thank you, Brendan, and all of you at DSMOG for all the work you've done over all these years, which is unique and extremely valuable to all of us who are working in climate change education. So you're a resource to those people who are doing the education, which makes you a double resource and especially appreciated by people like myself.
Well, thank you very much. It's a big team effort, but we're not going anywhere. We've got, like I said, a global team, and we're just going to keep doing what we do. And look forward to hearing from any of your listeners. If they want to contact us at the website, we've got a contact form, or just happy to continue to pursue a more just future.
Absolutely. Brendan DeMel, Executive Director of DSMOG. He's also a freelance writer and researcher specializing in media, politics, climate change, and clean energy. You can go to www.dsmog.com. DSMOG, like getting rid of the smog, dsmog.com. My name is Bob DiBenedetto. I want to thank you for listening to the Healthy Planet radio program. I'll be with you again next Friday, May 8th, at this same time, that's right, at 6 p.m. For more info on any Healthy Planet events, and we don't have live events now, and who knows if we will for the rest of the year, but our website is www.healthyplanetusa.org, and our Facebook page is Healthy Planet USA. To get on our email list for all upcoming events, email us at info@healthyplanetusa.org. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives and the Healthy Planet shows every week at this time, with really great hosts sharing cutting-edge health and environmental information. That's every week at this time, Fridays at 6 p.m. Until next time, stay strong. Keep moving, even at home. Relax. Make your voice heard in the world by speaking up for what's right, even if the political climate is challenging. Be kind to those around you. And those around you right now are the people in your home, and that's especially tough at this time, perhaps. But also be kind to your amazing four-legged friends who add so much to our lives, and enjoy this beautiful world and temporarily much cleaner air that we all share. Good night.
Has global warming finally gotten your attention? Well, it's not just about pleasantly balmy winters. Other impacts include disruption of our food supply, hunger, warm climate pest infestations, rising sea waters, resulting in displacement of millions, and much more. You don't need to wait for the government to act to change the dangerous course that the vast majority of scientists say we're on. Healthy Planet is a non-profit organization that teaches that many of the world's most daunting health and environmental problems have their solution in the choices we make every day. One of the most important actions you can take to reduce global warming gases is to eat lower on the food chain. That's right, less meat equals less pollution. In fact, a new UN report states that livestock production is a greater source of global warming gases than transportation, as well as being a leading cause of water pollution and a loss of biodiversity in the world. And reducing your meat consumption can pay you back personally, with reduced risks of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer, to name a few. For more on this, and to attend Healthy Planet's popular educational and social events, call them at 631-421-5591 or visit them on the web at www.healthy-planet.org. A healthy planet is ours to create.
Ever think of light bulbs as being cool? They are if you choose energy-efficient bulbs and fixtures that have earned the government's Energy Star label. They're so hot, they're cool. Because they burn cool and last up to 10 times longer, you save money and oodles of energy. Change a light, help the environment, save some green. The solution is as close as your nearest lamp socket. Brighten your environmental future. From the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.